system, and we're going to try to disentangle. And by doing so, we're going to be able to define reversibility or irreversibility in a fairly general way. We're going to see that this is related to statistical fluctuations of the entanglement. And at the end, I'll give you some points for thought, some things that we believe are still open problems, and other little things that might be interesting for discussion, and a summary. So if you want to interrupt me with questions, please feel free at any time. I really like to entertain questions along the way. Usually these are the you know, that things get a little bit more clear. So we don't leave to, you know, all the questions to the end. So there you go, motivation. So let's go back and talk about classical mechanics for a moment. And particularly, let's try to understand how irreversibility comes up in classical mechanics. And we know that irreversibility happens when we have some kind of chaotic motion. What I mean by chaotic motion is a motion that is very sensitive to initial conditions. That means if you have two starting points, you can think of this as a phase space, and they're slightly different from each other. Just it could be exponentially close, but not exactly on top of each other. And when you allow your classical system to evolve over time, you have some kind of trajectory in the phase space. And after a finite time, you find that these two points, which are the current positions in phase space of your system with these two different initial conditions, they can be quite far apart, even though they started exponentially close. So there is what we call an exponential sensitivity to the small change in the initial condition. And this is captured by what is called the Lyapunov of exponents. So if you look at the deviations from the initial position up to the final position of these two trajectories, you're going to see that they can be departed by an exponential amount. So that's it's basically at the core of irreversibility in classical mechanics, this kind of effect, right? What happens now if you go to quantum mechanics? Well, the first thing you notice that if you try to extend this concept of chaos and sensitivity to initial conditions to quantum mechanics, you run into trouble. Looks like it's impossible. And it's actually true. And the reason is because, contrary to classical mechanics, in quantum mechanics, evolution is always unitary, right? So it's kind of a preserving type of evolution. And that limits tremendously the sensitivity to, you know, exponential sensitivity. You know, things cannot explode, you know, exponentially. It's easy to see that, for instance, if you take two initial states, let's say this is your state vector at time zero, and you have a slight deviation, you're looking at two different initial conditions for your state vector, and let's call this the delta psi zero as your initial deviation. And then you evolve these two initial states according to some unitary evolution, right? You get as, you know, two different state vectors at the end. But then when you look at the difference between these two state vectors, you find that the magnitude are the same. And that has to be because the evolution is unitary. So you can never see any exponential sensitivity to initial conditions in quantum mechanics. So this way of defining irreversibility in quantum mechanics in light of classical mechanics is not very useful. So we have to think of something else. So, you know, people have thought a lot about that. So an alternative way to look into this problem is to consider what we call the Loschmidt echo. Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Yeah. Oh, there you go. Yeah, but it's actually it's a very simple exercise. I had it here and I took it out. You can actually prove that the norm of these deviations is not altered by the evolution. You know, as long as you use the same evolution for these two, it actually you end up with the same norm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're not equal, right? But the norms are the same. Mm-hmm. Okay, so going back to this, so how do you go around this difficulty? Well, you can do something. You can do the following. You can look at what happens in the evolution, the quantum mechanical evolution, if you use one operator to go forward and one that is slightly different to come back. So that's the idea of the Loschmidt echo. So what we're going to do is we're going to evolve the system with some H Hamiltonian. Let's say we do a Hamiltonian evolution. But on the way back, we add a slight small perturbation, right? a non-trivial one, so that H and V are and they don't commute. And to capture that effect, we calculated what people call the fidelity. So you start out with some initial state here, you evolve at a certain time with the Hamiltonian H, and then you try to evolve back with a slightly modified Hamiltonian, right? And then you compare with what you started with. Take the magnitude of this square, that's called fidelity. So what is reversibility and irreversibility in the language of fidelity? Well, people recognize that if this fidelity over time decays very fast, like exponentially fast, then most likely you have a system which is going through some sort of irreversibility. It's very, very hard to, you know, even a tiny perturbation in your, you know, counter-evolution destroys everything, gets you to a state that is completely orthogonal to what you started with, right? But if you find that the decay is very slow, then probably the system is not very sensitive to perturbations. That means it's fairly easy to find a way, even if you make a mistake, you can, you know, in your Hamiltonian along the on the way back, you can still recover quite a bit of your initial state. Yeah. Yeah, it's a small non-zero epsilon, absolutely. Yeah, then you know, then you get one every time. Yeah.
Have you optimized
Muller view? That's a good question. You may want to do that to be a little bit more rigorous in the in this definition. Yeah. So you can try to find the V that gives you the fastest decay, right? And on, and then if the fastest decay is still, you know, relatively slow, then you have a reversible system, absolutely. You can make this a little bit more rigorous, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, a question?
Maybe a weaker definition, which is just that local observables could be the same, even though the state.
Yes, yes, correct. Yeah, you can look into that too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm just giving you the, you know, general glimpse of, you know, what people are thinking about in terms of irreversibility in quantum mechanics, but absolutely, you can do that. So, now, Asher Peres, a long time ago, about 30 years ago, he kind of conjectured, and he had a pretty good reason to do that, that you have irreversibility every time H, that Hamiltonian, is non-integrable. And what do you mean by non-integrable? Well, I mean that this Hamiltonian H has essentially no conserved quantities. You know, energy, of course, is conserved if H is constant over time. But besides that, and perhaps some kind of discrete symmetries, there's no other, no big symmetry or a collection of conserved quantities. So you have a Hamiltonian, which is pretty well described by what we call random matrix theory in some bases. So when he said that in these cases, it's irreversible. In contrast, if H is integrable, that means it has, you know, a sufficiently large number of conserved quantities, as many as the degrees of freedom that, you know, that the Hamiltonians try to describe, then you have a reversible system. And that seemed to be a really good definition, really good way to separate between reversibility and irreversibility. Yes?
So I'm assuming you're considering an extended system.
Yes.
And then when you talk about the conserved quantity, do you mean something that can be expressed as a sum of a local density? Or, I mean, given H, you can always find many
ways
to commute with it.
So correct. And actually, this is a good point. See, if you have a Hamiltonian that is finite, say you have a discrete Hilbert space, right? So your Hamiltonian is, you can write it as a finite size matrix. You can always diagonalize the matrix, right? So in a way, this issue of having no conserved quantities, you know, for a finite matrix is not really very clear. So I think what people had mostly in mind here is a continuous system, you know, like a system that is infinitely dimensional. You know, do you have a, it's not a finite Hilbert space, because when you have a finite Hilbert space, you know, you can always do some kind of unit trace transformation and turn your Hamiltonian into something diagonal, and then you can say, okay, so then, you know, if it's diagonal, you know, it's integral by definition, because you already have everything out there. So there's always a basis where everything is diagonal. But I think what people have in mind here is was a little bit more general, was a definition that could all work also not only for, you know, it could also work for continuous systems where you can actually not necessarily find a transformation that diagonalizes the matrix so easily. I think this is one point. But I don't know if I answered your question. Maybe I went off the.
Because, you know, if I have a three-dimensional field of space, I may still be able to diagonalize.
Yeah.
It's only when we talk about solving a problem we mean realizing the final time. Regardless of
yes.
whether it's a finite dimension or a three dimensional total space.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm assuming here is that when we talk about conserved quantities, we in an extended system, we have some structure in mind. Probably we mean that this conserved quantity is the sum of local.
Oh, I see. I got you now. When you said extend, I was having something else in mind. Yes, absolutely. I think you're right. So you need to have something that can be expressed in terms of like a density operator, you're saying? Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, I missed the point entirely. Yeah.
I mean, projection operators on
yeah.
space
yeah.
have usually
yeah.
extended
yes.
very
uh-huh.
nice things. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. He had a question there first.
Well, I was just thinking
mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I wasn't going to touch that, but since you mentioned, for systems where you have a classical counterpart, then it's pretty easy to define non-integrability as opposed to integrability. The problem is with systems which do not have obvious classical counterpart. Then you're in a you know it things are a little bit more difficult to define rigorously.
So
yeah.
Instance, like,
yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now is your question.
Do you want H plus epsilon B to also be integrable?
No, it's all about H in principle, right? It should be a property of H, not a property of V. Okay?
But presumably V is a sum of local
terms. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you could put a yeah absolutely. So you, if you have an H that is integrable, and a V that is very complicated, then overall you break integrability, right? But you try to put a perturbation that is that maybe is not that general. But maybe I should skip that for now, and we can go back to that at the end if you want, because there are lots of subtle points. And the really interesting thing is that you can see that this way of looking things is very tricky, because it has a lot to do with the way you define things. You know, what kind of are you talking about extended quantities or V that is as simple as the Hamiltonian or more complicated than the Hamiltonian. All these things seem to be fine, but when you look at you know a little bit closer, you can see that there are lots of points that are really not very clear in these definitions or in this way of looking at things. So, and that was the whole point we are trying to look. We look at this, it looks all very fuzzy, very complicated. You have to define all these you know subtle points to try to make this correspondence between integrability and irreversibility. And even there is even a worse thing. People actually, fairly recently, they came up with Hamiltonians, which are integrable, but have a very fast fidelity decay. Yeah. So that was really, you know, make just everything look really, really complicated. So what we try to do is to avoid of this. That's why I don't want to talk too much about this, because I think there's a much simpler, much cleaner way to look at irreversibility and integrability in the context of quantum mechanics. And it's about looking at entanglement. So I'm not going to be looking at, you know, the Hamiltonian itself, but rather I'm going to be looking at the entanglement that is encoded in the state that you're trying to reverse back to its original form, okay? And if you do that, then you can forget about Hamiltonian evolution completely. You don't even need a Hamiltonian. I mean, you don't have to have a constant Hamiltonian to define all these things. These are very much based on the fact that you have a constant evolution, or you know, constant Hamiltonian evolution. Whereas if you look at entanglement, you don't need that anymore. So that's the point, right? So let's see if I convince you that looking at things in this way is better than going to this complicated picture. So for that, I'm going to use a model system. Much of what I'm going to tell you today was done numerically, right? There is a lot of things here that we know that we can justify a little bit analytically here and there, but the work is mostly done numerically. So let's begin with a system of qubits. So I have n qubits, right? You can dispose them on a line if you wish, right? So the total Hilbert space is a direct product of all these two-dimensional Hilbert space, right, on a complex support. And so if you take a pure state in this Hilbert space, of course, you can calculate the density matrix very simply. I'm going to assume this system is, the system is isolated, so all the states are pure states. And one useful thing, if you want to talk about entanglement, is bipartition the system. So imagine, for instance, that I break the system into two sets of qubits, right? Subsystem A and subsystem B, right? The sum of the number of qubits in each one is, of course, the total number of qubits. The Hilbert space is now factorized. But once I do that, I can define the reduced density matrix of subsystem A by tracing over the degrees of freedom, the qubits of system B, right? So everybody knows that. What maybe you haven't thought too much about is that once you have this reduced density matrix, it's a Hermitian matrix, right, with positive Hermitian matrix. So if you look at the eigenvalues of this reduced density matrix, you're going to have a collection of positive or zero numbers, right? So it's a semi-positive collection, collection of semi-positive numbers. And if you did things properly, they are normalized. They obey this sum rule, okay? So they are going to be the ingredients in all my calculations. All my entangled calculations are going to be based on the spectrum of the reduced density matrix. Sometimes we're going to cut the system in half, or we can cut it in many different ways. Sometimes we average over these cuts, if you wish, by partitions. Sometimes we look only at the middle. And so we're going to be working with these guys, okay? So how do we measure entanglement once you have the spectrum of a reduced density matrix? We use what people call, they go by many names, but we call this Rényi entropies, which are basically logs of the sums of these lambdas with particular powers. And the powers are integers. I'm interested only in integer powers, so I go from 0 to 1 and so on and so forth, right? And you can see, for instance, if I take Q equals 0, right, as long as lambda is non-zero, I get a contribution of 1 to the sum. If lambda is 0, I get a 0. So at the end, for Q equals 0, my Rényi entropy is basically the log of the rank of the reduced matrix. What's the rank of a matrix? It's just the number of non-zero eigenvalues, okay? Right? So, and if I go to Q equals 1, I get von Neumann's entropy, right? And I can go to 2 and 3 and so on and so forth. I just get more complicated, like you may say, like higher moments of, say, of this spectrum, right? And so on. So we're going to be looking at these guys as well. So we're going to measure the entanglement by looking at the Rényi entropies associated to reduced density matrix of a certain bipartition of the system. Now, there is a hierarchy between these Rényi entropies, they have to be equal or larger than the number of qubits in your partition, right? And each successive Rényi entropy is equal or smaller than the previous one. So there is a hierarchy of them, right? And they're all positive or equal to zero, right? Mm-hmm. So now what about the time evolution? So I want to try to evolve the system over time and see if I can return back. So I'm going to use a stochastic circuit for that. So I'm going to start with my initial state is a product state. Each one of these psi's is basically a non-entanglement, of course, a product state. So each one of them is a random superposition between 0 and 1 for each one of these factors here, right? And the angle here is just a random angle between 0 and pi. So what I do is that I draw these, so n angles to begin with, right? I put my qubits in a superposition, and then I take the direct product for all these superpositions, right? That's my initial state, no entanglement. Now, I do a unitary evolution of this initial state, right? And the unitary evolution is going to be broken into, if you wish, cycles, like clock cycles. So on every one of these cycles, I have one particular type of unitary operation, right? So I'm going to break this into a sequence of gates, we're going to call them. Mm-hmm. Number one all the way to the largest I want. And each one of these unitary operations now that I call gates, actually, like logic gates, I'm going to use one qubit gates and two qubit gates. The one qubit gates that I'm mostly interested in are the NOT gate, Hadamard, and the phase gates. I'm going to explain what they are in a moment. And for the two-qubit gates, all I need is a C-naught, which is like an XOR. Mm-hmm. So my circuit is going to be comprised by a random sequence of these 1 and 2 qubit gates, you know, drawn with certain distribution, usually a uniform distribution, right? And acting on random pairs of gates or in random gates along my string. So that's what I call the random circuit. NOT gate, everybody probably knows about it. It just flips the state from 0 to 1 or 1 to 0. The phase gate keeps the state, but adds a phase to the one component of that state, right? It can be a pi over 4 or a pi over 2. Pi over 4 is what we call the T, and the pi over 2 is the S. A Hadamard gate is one that creates a superposition, a positive one if it begins with the 0 state, and a negative one if it begins with the 1 state. And then the C naught is the XOR, right? It flips the second state when the first one is a 1, right? And it's denoted by this kind of symbol here. So now one thing that you have to have in mind is that subsets of these gates can comprise universal sets. So for instance, if you take an Hadamard, a T, and a C naught, this set of gates can span the entire unitary group. So you can approximate any unitary transformation by, you know, a sequence of these guys. There is always a sequence where you can build so that any unitary transformation can be written in terms of them. Yeah.
So by span, do you mean like the set generated by those gates?
Correct.
Are dense in the space of all.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, and of course, you know, if you have a very complicated unitary gate with some kind of irrational number, then you're going to have an infinite number of these guys. But you only need these guys and nothing else, right? If you substitute T by S, on the other hand, you no longer get a complete set for the unitary evolution, but you get what people call the Clifford group, which is also important, but it's not universal. And having unitary evolution that is universal means that you can do universal quantum computing with these gates, right? All right. So we're going to be looking at reversibility and irreversibility for these different sets of gates, some universal, some others not universal. So just to give an example, so the circuit is defined by this sequence of random gates. For instance, if I, in this particular case of a H naught and a C naught for 8 bits, that's how it looks. So I randomly choose bits for every one of my clock cycles, right? If it's a 1-bit gate that I'm going to try to apply, then I pick one gate randomly. And if it's a pair, then I pick two bits to make up my pair. And then I randomly choose what kind of gate I want. And so I end up with something that looks like this. So I begin with a product state, each one of these bits in a random superposition. And at the end of the day, I get a many-body wave function that is likely, you know, fairly entangled, okay? So once I have this guy here, my wave function at the m step, after m gates, then I can compute the reduced density matrix, whatever partition I want, and then I can find the spectrum of the density matrix, and then I can compute the Rene entropies. That's the recipe, okay? So so let me begin now showing you some of the numerical results. So I'll show you results today for 16 bits. Every time I show you the statistics, it's going to be a bipartition in two halves, equal halves. Every now and then, I'm going to do averages over different halves, and different partition will let you know when that happens. I used 112 gates to do my, what we call the heat up, the heating of the system, right? And typically, I think in all the data that I'm going to show today, I have I do an average over 5,000 samples of those random circuits, right? So this is the result, for instance, for these three sets of gates. So for the C naught, H plus naught, which is not universal, right? I can see that the Q0 Rene entropy goes quickly to the maximum possible value it can have, which is 8, right? Remember, this is basically the rank of the reduced density matrix. So it should jump in integers, right? But because I did an average here, it kind of smooths out. So it's continuously, but if you take one circuit alone, if you put a graph like this for a circuit, you're going to see that it goes into steps. And if Q equals 1 goes up as well, it doesn't quite reach its maximum possible value, but that's actually that's just a finite size system effect, right? The bigger the system, the more gates you get, the closer these two lines will be, right? And for all of these sets, I get pretty much the same behavior of the average entropy as a function of gate number. You can see they're fairly, you know, pretty close, if not almost identical, right? That's important. But remember that this, for instance, these two sets are not universal sets, whereas this one is. But overall, these entropies behave the same way, right? So there's no way to distinguish these sets by just looking at the entropy alone. It's the first message. Now, let me tell you a little bit about some features here. We already talked about the value of the entropies after so many gates, right? One thing that I don't have data here to show today, but I can tell you is that if you look at the variance of these entropies at this point, not only the average but the variance of the zero Q0 entropy is zero because it's just an integer. Once it gets to the maximum possible rank for the reduced matrix, it stays there, right? Doesn't change anymore. So the variance goes to zero. But the variance of S1 is interesting. It turns out it's actually fairly large. The reason why you don't see any fluctuations here is because of the very large number of samples that I used. But if you were to look at, you know, sample by sample, this graph, you would see this curve all over the place. So the variance is actually pretty big. It's essentially a number of order one. And we look at different system size, and we don't seem to change very much. So we believe that there might be some universality there. And I'll get back to that at the end of the talk. So we're going to call these states, after so many gates, 512 gates, what we call the maximally entangled states, the maximum that I can get for a given my finite size system. Okay, so they're going to be the ones that we're going to try now to reverse. Okay, so I wait until I get the maximally possible entanglement that I can get. I stay there for a while, make sure that everything is stable. Then I'm going to try to reverse these guys. So how do I do that? Is it possible to reverse the circuit? You say, obviously, just take all the gates you applied to get there and apply them in reverse order, right? And then, of course, you're going to go back to the initial state when mechanics is reversible, after all. But that's not what I want to do. I want to try to get to that state and then forget about how I got there and see if I can, you know, I can figure out a way back without knowing how I got there. If I can guess the circuit. Is it possible to guess? Does it take a polynomial amount of time or an exponential amount of time to find this way back? So let's see. So for that, we have to come up with what we call the disentangling algorithm, which is essentially a Metropolis algorithm. So give me a state that is maximally entangled, and I'm going to try to go back to a product state. How do I do that? Well, what I do is that I compute the entanglement entropies. And usually for that, I compute over all possible, you know, linear bipartitions. Like I put them all the bits on a line, and then I bipartition, you know, in half, or, you know, half plus one, and so on. So I look at all these kind of linear bipartitions, not the 2 to the n bipartition that I may have, but just, you know, an n number of bipartitions. So I have some kind of average behavior of the entanglement along my string of bits. And then I choose a gate, a random gate from a fixed set. I apply the gate, and then I recompute the entanglement entropies, again, taking the average, right? And then I look if the entropies are getting reduced or not. If I apply, after applying the gate, my entropy got reduced, then I keep the gate in my list, my reverse list. If the entropy increases, then I draw randomly a number between 0 and 1. If that number is smaller than exponential of the entropy minus divided by some temperature, if you wish, right? Some parameter that I can fit, or I can not fit, but I can choose for my algorithm, then I add the gate to the list. If that doesn't work, I discard the gate, and then I start again. And I try to do that until, you know, I clean up. I get to the zero entropy again, right? Now, does that always work or not? Let's find out. So I'm going to show you here, even though I have 5,000 samples for every set of circuits, it would take me a few years to check all of them in my little cluster. So I sampled 100 out of the 5,000. I tried to reverse 100 out of 5,000. And what I found is that in my 100 attempts for this particular set of gates, I always get to reverse it. Yes? Yes, not necessarily the original one, absolutely. Yeah.
And something else, like, if you didn't look at a half by partition, but you took a different limit, which is a thermodynamic limit for the rest of the system and a finite subsystem, then for C naught H, C naught H and S, I think it's known that the reduced density matrix is just the identity.
Right, yeah, so, but I never do that. Yeah, correct.
Then, so is it, how important is it that it's exactly half the system? Because
no, not important. Yeah. So the reason why, you know, I could have done the cooling algorithm by looking at how the entropy in the middle of, let's say I put all my bits on a string, right? And I do the partition right at the middle. So I have, let's say, out of 16 bits, I can have qubits, I can have 8 on the left, 8 on the right, and then I follow the entropy at that point, right? Correct. Yeah, and we do that. When we do the average, we look at, let's say, I think the smallest I got is 2 against 14 on the left, and then I do 3 against 13, 4 against, and so on. So I do all, calculate all these entropies for all these different partitions, right, by partitions. And then I average over all these entropies, right? So in a way, it is there, but remember, I have only 16 bits. I don't have a large number, right? So I think what you're worried about is that if I do a very large number, and I do this partition where I have, let's say, 1 against n minus 1, I'm going to start to see the fact that I can build an identity operator using C naught, S, and naught. Is that what you're saying?
No, just that there are exactly those that say that reduced density matrix for polydex. Will give rise to max. The density matrix is just the identity on part A.
Mm.
So,
yeah, because okay, I got it. Okay, I think I got what you're saying. You're saying that if I apply enough number of gates, right? And these gates are, there's some randomness on them, you know, and so on. Will I actually get to a point where my reduced density matrix is just the identity matrix, which means that I have essentially a thermal average, right? That's a good question. I think, first, we never see that with a finite system.
Sure, but your yes. question you see here is like, so from half by partition, it's
yes.
known that there's a minus one correction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Damage means you're being n over 2, then to minus 1.
Yeah. Well, not true, because I can tell you this. So it doesn't matter how I partition, I more or less see the same behavior, right? The actual value of the entropy is not the same, of course, for different partitions. But the overall behavior is always the same. I do not see the density matrix for you know, this set, for instance, evolving into a identity matrix at all, right? And it could be that it's a bit of like a finite size effect, but I think it's a little more than that. If I think for a second, I don't think we ever reach that this ideal thermal limit where the density matrix is essentially just one. We never hit to a point where this is true. It would be like an infinite temperature. Yeah, we never reach that. That's a good point. Maybe I should go back to that at the end, because I think I can tie that up with some other discussions that I may have, okay? But I don't see it. I see your point, but it's not something that I see in the simulation. Okay, so I already spoiled this, taking too much. So for the H, C naught, and S, it's again always reversible, but if I use C naught, H, and T, it's never reversible. When I mean never reversible, it means that it doesn't bulge. Right? It's not that it fluctuates down. It doesn't even change. It doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't really move. But again, remember from the beginning, for all these three sets of circuits, the entropy at the maximally entangled state is the same. So I start out with the maximally entangled state every single time, right? But I get these very, very different results. So the entropy alone is not a signature of whether you can reverse or not the dynamics. There's something else there. And there's something else is the actual fluctuations that are embedded into this entanglement spectrum, So the entropy alone cannot tell you that. You have to go deeper into the spectrum. So what I mean by fluctuations? Well, let's go back to reduced density matrix, right? Oh yeah, go, sorry.
If you had chosen better, I would be able to.
Yeah, well, no. I mean, one thing I can do, we tried a couple of different things. You can see that this delta S here, I haven't told you which S I'm following. Am I following S0, S1, S2? I tried all of them, and I tried even combinations of them. I say, okay, maybe I reduced S1, but I didn't reduce S2, then I should throw this out, and I should only accept gates that reduce both entropies. It turns out that, you can play with this quite a bit. You can play with the temperature. It doesn't really matter. When something is irreversible, it's always, I was not able to tweak this algorithm to find a way to reverse it. And similarly, if it's reversible, the only effect of tweaking with this entropies and temperature is just to postpone the point where the entropy goes to zero. Sometimes I reach it faster, sometimes I reach it later. But it works in all ways. But I always use this Metropolis algorithm. I haven't tried anything else. If you have a good idea of another algorithm, we can try. This seems to be fairly general. It's the same one that people use for, No, I don't think it's actually it's the opposite of getting stuck. It's everywhere in a way. It's a superposition of, doesn't decrease. I'll show you the plots. Yeah.
Is that result? I think the result is intuitively clear, right?
Where yeah.
In terms of you've chosen a universal set of gates, which can explore the whole Hilbert space, versus a set of gates which is not universal, which means that they can only explore a limited number of.
Yeah, but they can explore, I would think that they can visit the Hilbert space in a kind of uniform way, but not necessarily dense.
But this could die, right.
Yeah, and that's correct. And I'm not saying that this is bad, it's actually good. It's easy to even understand why it works, right? But we have to do it to prove it, yeah? So, show you some data here. Go back to the fluctuations though. So the way to pick this effect is to look at the entanglement spectrum. So you may be tempted to look first at the density of the spectrum, but I'll tell you this, the density is very featureless. It's very boring. It doesn't really change very much from one set of gates to the other. It's something there, it's very, non-informative and can vary by orders of magnitude, and it's very complicated to work with. But it's much better to look at the statistics of, you kind of zoom into the spectrum, the eigenvalues of your spectrum, and then look at the spacing between the eigenvalues and see how that spacing fluctuates, right? So rather than looking at the overall density, you look at the spacing of those guys. But there's a problem because, of course, since the average density varies so much, comparing the fluctuations between big eigenvalues gives you a result, quantitative result, that is, different than if you look at the little eigenvalues. So to make everybody, give everybody the same weight when you build the distribution, you do, instead of looking at this fluctuation here, you do the ratios of the fluctuations. That takes care of any modulation due to the different densities along the spectrum. And this is what we call the ratio of consecutive level spacings, the distribution of that, right? So let's take a look at the results. Oh, before I go that, of course, if you have an uncorrelated spectrum where the levels can be anywhere they want, then it's a Poisson-like statistics, and it's pretty easy to define to derive a distribution for this ratios of consecutive spacings. It's this form. But if you have a correlated eigenvalues, let's say eigenvalues that could be coming out of a random matrix, there wasn't any way to get this distribution until some people actually came up with a surmise, which is a fairly good approximation to the exact distribution. This was done just about a year ago by a group in France. So now we actually have an analytical curve that we can compare to the numerical data. And this beta here stands for the three different Wigner-Dyson ensembles. Maybe you're not familiar with that, but back in the 50s, people in nuclear physics were looking at the spectra of that comes out of neutron scattering experiments, basically energy levels of nuclei, and they noticed that, you know, they're all over the place. They were very random. So people start to look at the statistics, the spacing of these energy levels, and they realize that they actually were quite rigid, right? There was some level of repulsion going on. And Wigner, in the beginning, and then Dyson and other people, they were able to build this theory. It's called the random matrix theory, where depending on the particular symmetry of your Hamiltonian, and only symmetry, you can actually predict how these fluctuations are going to be like, what the distribution of these single particle spacings. And the three main symmetry classes are called orthogonal, unitary, and symplectic. The orthogonal one has to do with systems that have time reversal symmetry, so that means all the eigenvectors can be written as real functions, real wave functions. The unitary one is when you have complex wave functions, that means you break time reversal symmetry, right? You need to use complex numbers. And the GSC is the symplectic one, happens when you have real eigenvectors, but you have, let's say, some kind of spinor or quaternion structure, right? So these are the three ensembles that happen very naturally for most systems in nature. So we have that, and these are very interesting because they have pretty different heads and tails. So for S going to zero, this one is a constant, whereas this one decays quadratically or linearly. And the tail also has a signature that is differentiates Wigner-Dyson from Poisson. So let's look at the results now. So for C naught, H and naught, right? Remember, this is not a universal set, and it's a reversible one. That's a typical heating and cooling diagram, right? So a particular sample, this here, I averaged the entropy over many partitions, right? That's why it doesn't go all the way to 8. It just gets some kind of average number, maximal number. You can see that it's heating. And then at this dashed line, I kick in my cooling algorithm, and you can see for a while, doesn't do much with Q equals zero, but it keeps on decreasing Q1, and that's because I used Q1 as my reference for the cooling, and eventually it hits bottom zero. So I was able to reverse back to a product state, right? And again, I only checked for 100 Ks out of 5,000 realizations. And this is what I get for these distributions. So the dots are the numerical data, and the curves, continuous and dashed, are for the different predictions for Poisson, GOE, and GUE. And you can see it falls really beautifully on a Poisson curve. So the reversible case, Poisson statistics for the eigenvalues of the reduced matrix. Let's look at another one. So let's look now at another one that is reversible. You can see here, right? Eventually, boom, hit bottom zero again, right? This is one out of 100 that I tried. Every single one worked. Not always the same point, but they worked. You can see it takes quite a bit of time to find a sequence, right, by trial and error. It was pretty easy to cool, takes a long time, pretty easy to heat, long time to cool, but it's doable. And this is, again, the result, again, Poisson statistics. Now, when you go back to the universal set, then things change quite a bit. Look at this. So it heats up more or less the same way as the other ones. It reached more or less the same maximum value for the entropies. But no matter what I do, I don't move out of that. I always keep the same entanglement. And you can see it's not that it, you know, it works and goes back. No, it doesn't really change at all. It's very, very hard to go find a way back, right? So this is my definition of irreversible. And if you look at the statistics, yeah, singular values, you get beautiful Wigner-Dyson. And by the way, you get GUE, which is what you expect, because once you have a T-gate, the T-gate has a phase, right? So it's it adds lots of complex numbers. So your eigenstate is going to be a superposition of a complex number. So you should be in the GUE symmetry class, like time versus symmetry breaking, kind of class. And that works pretty well. So we do see a GUE. Yeah?
So you started on purpose with real initial states.
Uh-huh.
Is that an artificial fact here?
No. Yeah, so if you start with complex, this only keeps you complex, right? This particular gate will only keep you constant, complex. If you start with complex and you try the other sets, which are non-universal, you still get Poisson.
You still get Poisson.
Yes, it doesn't really make much of a difference. Yeah. it gets, well, I'll tell you one case where it gets a little complicated, but we can understand why. Mm-hmm. But in this, for these examples, it doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, we even have in the code the complex phase, but we turn it off because it wasn't making any difference mm-hmm. for the initial state. So just go back to a little bit. I'm close to wrap up now. So final thoughts and a few words. So back to Hamiltonian systems, right? There's something interesting about that. We already talked about it, but let me emphasize. So if you have a constant Hamiltonian is constant over time, makes sense to talk about energy levels, right? And people know that if it's an integrable system, whatever integral means for a quantum mechanical system, for quantum mechanical Hamiltonians, Michael Berry and Tabor in 77 conjectured that every integrable system, quantum mechanical integrable system, must have Poisson statistics for the energy levels. Talking about energy now, right? And pretty soon after, people realized that if the systems, on the other hand, are non-integrable, they're like chaotic type, then the statistics of the energy levels is always Wigner-Dyson. But again, the problem we see with this is that doesn't tell me very well whether the Hamiltonian is going to be the reversible type or the irreversible type, right? There are lots of examples where integrable systems have very fast decaying fidelity, and they look like the same kind of decay that you expect for non-integrable systems. So it's not a clear-cut connection between being integrable in the Hamiltonian alone and then being reversible. But with our results, I think we can then put a new conjecturing on, out there, which says that, well, the correspondence between integrability and the reversibility is not done at the level of energy Hamiltonian, but rather at the level of the entanglement. So the entanglement is a clear-cut separation between reversible and irreversible, depending on the type of statistics you see in the spectrum, right? And then if you want to associate integrability and non-integrability to the entanglement spectrum, then you have a well-defined definition between these concepts of integrability and non-integrability, and then reversibility and non-reversibility. But you have to know what you look at, what's the actual indicator for that. Right? So this is true, but not for the energy levels, but rather for the statistics of the entanglement spectrum. So that's the punchline. I show you a little bit another evidence, and this is another set. This is a set that is not complete for quantum computing, right? In fact, these are all real gates, right? They're actually called permutation gates in this way. And so this is actually universal for classical computation. A Toffoli gate plus alone is already enough for universal classical computation. You put a C naught and a naught, you just embellish a little bit, but it's still universal, right? And for this set, we actually tried to do this cooling, and again, we see that it doesn't work. Actually, the heating happens so fast that you cannot even see here. I had to kind of zoom in this region over here so you can see that there was a period of heating. And then I spent a long time trying to cool and it didn't work. It's the same idea. And the black line is the average over 128 samples, and these two brown lines are just two different runs. So you can see how much it fluctuates. That's for S1. Yes.
What's the initial state here?
It's the same one. It's a random state. Random. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So irreversible again. And then if you look at the spectrum, the statistics of the entanglement spectrum, this time instead of looking at the ratio, I really looked at the spacing distribution, and I had to do some complicated unfolding. That was an early work. But again, you see a really nice Wigner-Dyson. But this time, because these gates are not complex gates, they're complete for classical computing, but not for quantum computing. There are no phases there. I get GOE. I get the orthogonal ensemble instead of the unitary one. Makes perfect sense, right? So, final comments and thoughts. One thing we notice that every time my average entropies, even after heating, do not reach the maximum possible entanglement. Typically, these are all reversible cases. But sometimes the statistics is not clear-cut Poisson. It kind of falls in between. Seems like these states did not fully develop you know, universality, one way or the other, right? For instance, if you do C naught and naught alone, you never get to see the entropy reaching a maximum value, and these are pretty easy to reverse, but you look at the statistics of the spectrum, they are not quite Poisson. They are close to Poisson, but not quite. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked us once, why do you go to the entanglement spectrum? Why can't you just take the log of the unitary operator, which is a sequence of the gates that you applied, multiply by n minus 1, that gives you a Hermitian matrix, right? Because these guys are unitary. And then look at the eigenvalues of that guy, right? What we call the eigenphases of the unitary operator. Should they be Wigner-Dyson when you have irreducibility and be Poisson when you have reversibility? Well, we tried that, it doesn't work at all. It's not as, you know, it doesn't have any feature, nothing that you can associate to reversibility, reversibility. For the permutation gates, in fact, I can prove to you that these eigenphases actually follow a picket fence spectrum. So they don't really have any information about the entanglement or the reversibility or reversibility. They're not really informative. Again, talking about universal entanglement fluctuations, so we notice that for S Q with Q larger than zero, the fluctuations are very large at the maximum entangled state, but they tend to be of order one and sort of independent of the system size. Makes us think that there is something that we call the universal entanglement fluctuation, which we're trying to prove a little bit more rigorously. In analogy to, I don't know if you ever heard about universal conductance fluctuations? No? Maybe? It was a very hot topic back in the 80s and 90s. Any disordered metal, when you look at the fluctuations of the conductance, the quantum fluctuation of the conductance, it doesn't matter the actual value of the average conductance, the fluctuations are always E squared over H. Have you ever heard of that? Yeah, so we think there's something at play here that is very similar to that mechanism that provides universal conductance fluctuations, but in context of entanglement. Yeah, yeah.
In relation to this last comment.
Yeah.
So if you pick up a random state in the Bloor state,
mm-hmm.
it's known to obey certain entanglement properties.
Is this
what we are referring to?
Yeah, I'll get to the point in a moment.
But it's being established. How it should scale over fluctuations around.
Yeah, actually, so if you have that, if you have a paper where they talk about this thing, I would like to see.
I'm thinking Patrick Heisen with Colorado.
The Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I found it just by accident. If it's people have proved that rigorously, I'm happy to concede. But I didn't see that before. Yeah. Yeah. If you have that, please show me.
It's a probabilistic statement. So it's like maybe like 99.99%
large number. So it's basically it's independent of the system size, which you're saying.
Well, it depends on the Hilbert space
dimension. Well, this one doesn't. That's the thing. Doesn't seem to scale with the system size. The only place where I've seen this before is with the conductance. And I think if they obey random matrix theory, I can even see how that thing comes about.
In that construction, there is no one dimension. In your construction, there is a one dimension.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they can go between anything. The one dimensionality comes about primarily when I do the bipartitions, because I'm not trying to do all the possible bipartitions of n objects.
Yes,
I'm just doing the ones that fit on a line. But other than that, it's, you know, I have long range interaction, short range, everything. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's interesting, it comes to this point. I'd like to try the same thing with a Hamiltonian evolution, like a many body Hamiltonian evolution, see if that thing, the same thing happens. One actually would have to think about how to do the disentangling algorithm for that case, because we don't have gates anymore. Right, we're going to have to try different two-body interactions or one-body interactions, two sections of them, and see if that works. But that's something that I've been thinking about. Somebody wants to talk about it, I'll be very happy. All right. Again, you spoiled my quick explanation about why it's Wigner-Dyson statistics, but it's pretty obvious by now, I guess. Right? If you do a universal unitary evolution, you know your state at the end of the universal unitary evolution is just a random vector in a complex Hilbert space, right? So that means all the the components of your vector in some bases are going to be just Gaussian distributed. Once they're Gaussian distributed and you use that vector to compute, to construct a random the reduced density matrix, obviously that random matrix density is going to be a bunch of Gaussians. So it's going to mimic like a random matrix, a matrix of random matrix theory, a Gaussian one from a Gaussian ensemble. So it's no surprise that we get to see the same kind of statistical behavior in that case. Mm-hmm. Poisson statistics, on the other hand, is when your vector is not a random vector anymore, not fully random, so the components are not quite Gaussian distributed. So when you build your reduced density matrix, you don't get something that follows the Gaussian ensembles. Right? The interesting thing is that always falls into something like a Poisson. That's actually surprising for us, but it does work this way. Okay, summary. So we have a different way to look at the relationship between irreversibility and non-integrability in quantum system. It has to do with entanglement. So we have this simple yet effective cooling algorithm that is able to disentangle when disentanglement is possible, and it doesn't work when the system is irreversible. And we find that this irreversibility is associated to Wigner-Dyson statistics, irreversibility associated to Poisson statistics. That's it. I think I spent an hour talking. So thank you very much for your attention. I think there's another question.
Let me ask a question instead of. So in the case where you have irreversibility, you have three gates, right? Would you try increasing the number of gates just to see if you can get out of that?
Oh, different sets?
Yeah. Just make that set maybe.
I'll tell you frankly, I tried once, what I find is that once you reach this maximum entangled state and you generated that with a universal set of gates, it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter. Whatever set you use, you can add more gates to your set, you can try different gates, it doesn't really change at all. Actually, I think what happens is that once you get to that point of heating, anything you apply heats even further. I mean, it just keeps the same temperature, if you wish. There's nothing that really allows it to cool. And I think it's the chance of you finding a path that takes you back to product state is probably, you know, the probability is probably exponentially small. You have to try an exponential number of different gates, you know, 2 to the n, where n is the number of bits probably that you have until you find something that works. So in practice, we don't see it. Mm-hmm.
So does that mean
I guess I can't prove that because it takes too long, but presumably no, not even that, because even small systems, when you put that into an exponential, it's pretty large. So I haven't tried 4. I started with 10 and up, so but it's I think it's probably true that you can exhaust all the possible gate combinations. It's an exponential number of possibilities, right? Eventually, you're going to find exactly the one. If nothing else, you're going to find the one that took you to that state. Once you apply that, it's going to work.
But your method may not accept that sequence because...
Yeah, I know.
So the algorithm may have to be changed.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, yeah. Even if they increase, yeah. So you're going to have to do some kind of high temperature search first and maybe cool it along the way. Yeah, absolutely. In principle, if you just bluntly try all possible combinations of gates, you're going to eventually find one that is at least the one that you used, right? That should work. There might be more than one, but at least that one should work. But you can see that even if you don't use the algorithm, you just try brute force, it's going to take a long time, right?
So
it's an exponential of an exponential, by the way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a bit confused about with the motivation, right? So you started by saying we might be interested in understanding irreversibility in the quantum setting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pointed out that the usual.
Yeah, it has all those problems we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. But then you did not. What you changed is the focus, right? You want to talk about irreversibility now of many body states.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not attached to the entanglement spectrum.
Well, I want to use the entanglement as a way to diagnose, if you wish.
But the entanglement is a property of a given state.
Yes.
And so it's still a you could still want to understand if there is a way of attaching a notion of irreversibility to quantum systems as defined by a Hamiltonian.
Yes. Yeah, and that's actually. Yeah, we haven't looked into that. The hunch is that it's going to work the same way, but we haven't done it, right?
The same way meaning?
Meaning, you if you do a quantum a Hamiltonian evolution.
So you take your Hamiltonian and you evolve according to that.
Right, and then you get to a certain state, right? Presumably entangled, right? If you have a sufficiently complicated Hamiltonian, just interactions and so on. What you can now try to do is to apply piecewise evolution operators that maybe comprise parts of your interaction until you find something that reverses you back to the product state. I don't know. So would that work or not?
Mm-hmm. But I thought that what was Schmidt, is that the name? So I thought that that definition was already a translation of a physical intuition.
Yes.
If you change a little bit your Hamiltonian, mm-hmm. or in the first place you don't know completely your Hamiltonian because it's experimentally impossible to know exactly your Hamiltonian, then the result of the evolution will be very sensitive on this
yes.
type of
decision. Yeah. So
I think that physical intuition, mm-hmm. that we don't need to touch that.
Well, except that it doesn't really work so well because you have integrable systems where the fidelity decays exponentially fast.
That's so, an intuition that reflects the idea of irreversibility.
Yes.
And maybe those integral systems in that particular sense are irreversible. I don't see the contradiction. Mm-hmm.
Well, sure. But then there is no clear-cut connection between integrability and reversibility.
Too bad.
Yeah, but this one has it. You see?
No, I know, but I don't see that the intuition, your definition goes to a specific algorithm that you designed.
Right.
So you create the state through a sequence of gates. You set the rules. They are completely legitimate, but still one can consider them artificial.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the algorithm that tries to get you back.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is very interesting, but I don't think it's a replacement for the original.
Well, sure, except that I think we have a more clear-cut, a more direct relationship between irreversibility and irreversibility with the statistics, which we may use to define integrability or not. I think I agree with you. I think it's a little more direct connection, because that one suffers the problem of, okay, maybe an integral system can be reversible or irreversible, right? So that means, I know, but that means that integrability alone is not sufficient to tell you whether things are reversible or not.
We just want to solve it.
That's right. But I'm telling you, okay, but if you want to make it more general statement, this might be a better way to do it. Mm-hmm. Somebody had a question on this side, no? No further questions. Oh, I have one more.
So, if you had started with some ground state of local Hamiltonian instead of this maximum. Would you expect to find this path?
Very good question. I don't know. On top of my head, I don't know. And I thought about it. It should be possible, but I don't know. I haven't tried yet. See, one problem I have here is that my intuition fails quite often in this problem. So I think we're still in the process of understanding, really, what's going on. I mean, we understand why we get Wigner-Dyson statistics, right? We kind of understand maybe why we get Poisson every now and then. But as he mentioned, we are looking at this in very particular situation, where we start with the product state, we reach this maximum entangled state. There could be situations in between, like if I already start with a state that is entangled, right? And then I go through the sequence of gates or interactions, if you wish, right? Can I reverse it back, not to the product state, but to this other initial state? Maybe not, maybe yes, I don't know. I mean, if the problem is that because I use entanglement as a way to guide me on the way back, I'm always going to look at the lowest entanglement. And if your initial state is not the one with the lowest entanglement, maybe I'm going to miss it, right? So I would have to have another criterion for reaching the target, or reversing to a state that is at least close to what was the initial state.
Fidelity.
Yeah.
Fidelity.
Could be. Yeah. Could be. But if I don't know the initial state, I can't calculate the fidelity. Right? So the good thing about starting with a product state is that you always know if you've got a product state or not. Maybe not the exactly one you started with, but a product state, right? But in this case, I don't know. I think it's going to be hard. I wouldn't say impossible. That I can't prove that it's impossible. It's probably difficult. All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.